Day one of the Senate confirmation hearing of Judge Amy Coney Barrett is in the books, with those on both sides of the aisle expressing their views on her nomination and the future of the Supreme Court before the Senate Judiciary Committee. We'll have more on that in a moment. This is Washington Today. For this, the 12th day of October, I'm your host, Nkoyo Iyamba. We are 22 days away from the presidential election, and both candidates are on the campaign trail today. Former Vice President Joe Biden campaigned across Florida and Ohio, while President Trump also headed south to the Sunshine State. In other news, Facebook is expanding its hate speech policy to include content that, quote, denies or distorts the Holocaust. This is a major shift for the platform, which has repeatedly come under fire for its inaction on hateful and false information. Facebook will now direct users to credible information if they search for content related to Holocaust denial on its platform. Fearing cyber attacks, Microsoft has disrupted a massive hacking operation that it said could have indirectly affected election infrastructure if allowed to continue. The company said Monday it took down the servers behind TrickBot, an enormous malware network that criminals were using to launch other cyber attacks, including a strain of highly potent ransomware. Microsoft said a federal court order allowed it to disable the IP addresses associated with TrickBot servers and worked with telecom providers around the world to stamp out the network. The action coincides with an offensive by U.S. Cyber Command to disrupt the cyber criminals, at least temporarily. That's according to the Washington Post. And the head of the World Health Organization called the herd immunity approach that some officials are taking for COVID-19 pandemic, quote, simply unethical. He said that earlier today. WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus said during a briefing that health officials usually attempt herd immunity from a disease by vaccinating the public, such as with measles. He said, quote, herd immunity is achieved by protecting people from a virus, not by exposing them to it, he said. You can read more on this topic at thehill.com. Now to Capitol Hill, where Judge Amy Coney Barrett faced her first day before the Senate Judiciary Committee. With the Q&A portion of the hearing slated to begin Tuesday, senators spent nearly 3 hours on Monday morning taking shots at each other and previewing what is expected to be heated hearings. President Trump nominated Judge Barrett late last month to succeed the late Justice Ginsburg, teeing off an explosive election year fight over the future of the Supreme Court. If Judge Barrett is confirmed, she'll lock in a 6-3 conservative majority. Democrats lashed out at Republicans for moving forward with Judge Barrett's nomination just 22 days before the election after refusing to give Judge Merrick Garland, that's President Obama's final Supreme Court nominee back in 2016, a hearing for a vote 8 months before that year's presidential election. Judge Amy Coney Barrett pledged in her opening remarks to be a justice who will apply the law, quote, as written, and paying tribute to justices across the ideological spectrum who came before her, such as Justices Antonin Scalia, Sandra Day O'Connor, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Here's a portion of her remarks.
Courts have a vital responsibility to the rule of law, which is critical to a free society. But courts are not designed to solve every problem or right every wrong in our public life. The policy decisions and value judgments of government must be made by the political branches, elected by and accountable to the people. The public should not expect courts to do so, and courts should not try. That is the approach that I have strived to follow as a judge on the Seventh Circuit. In every case, I have carefully considered the arguments presented by the parties, discussed the issues with my colleagues on the court, and done my utmost to reach the result required by the law, whatever my own preferences might be. I try to remain mindful that while my court decides thousands of cases a year, each case is the most important one to the litigants involved. After all, cases are not like statutes, which are often named for their authors. Cases are named for the parties who stand to gain or lose in the real world, often through their liberty or livelihood. When I write an opinion resolving a case, I read every word from the perspective of the losing party. I ask myself how I would view the decision if one of my children was the party that I was ruling against. Even though I would not like the result, would I understand that the decision was fairly reasoned and grounded in law? That is the standard that I set for myself in every case, and it is the standard that I will follow so long as I am a judge on any court. When the president offered me this nomination, I was deeply honored. But it was not a position I had sought out, and I thought carefully before accepting. The confirmation process and the work of serving on the court, if confirmed, requires sacrifices, particularly from my family. I chose to accept the nomination because I believe deeply in the rule of law and the place of the Supreme Court in our nation. I believe Americans of all backgrounds deserve an independent Supreme Court that interprets our Constitution and laws as they are written. And I believe I can serve my country by playing that role. I come before this committee with humility about the responsibility that I have been asked to undertake and with appreciation for those who have come before me. I was 9 years old when Sandra Day O'Connor became the first woman to sit in this seat. She was a model of grace and dignity throughout her distinguished tenure on the court. When I was 21 years old and just beginning my career, Ruth Bader Ginsburg sat in this seat. She told the committee, "What has become of me could only happen in America." I have been nominated to fill Justice Ginsburg's seat, but no one will ever take her place. I will be forever grateful for the path she marked and the life she led. If confirmed, it would be the honor of a lifetime to serve alongside the Chief Justice and 7 Associate Justices. I admire them all and would consider each a valued colleague. And I might bring a few new perspectives to the bench. As the president noted when he announced my nomination, I would be the first mother of school-aged children to serve on the court. And I know that it would make Senators Young and Braun happy to know that I would be the first justice to join the court from the 7th Circuit in 45 years. I would be the only sitting justice who didn't attend school at Harvard or Yale, but I am confident that Notre Dame could hold its own, and maybe I could even teach them a thing or two about football.
That was Judge Amy Coney Barrett earlier today during day one of her confirmation hearing. Senate Judiciary Chairman Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, took a few minutes during the hearing to submit into record a letter from the architect of the Capitol saying the room for the hearing was CDC compliant. Now, that's after Democrats chided the Republicans for pushing ahead during the pandemic without proper precautions. Senator Graham said he was tested a week ago Friday. That's after brief contact with Senator Mike Lee, the Republican of Utah, who recently tested positive, but whose doctor said he was clear to return to work. He was in the hearing in person on Monday. Here's Chairman Graham.
So if I may, I'll start off with an opening statement and say, why are we here? Number one, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died on September the 18th. What can you say about Justice Ginsburg? She was confirmed 96-3. Now, those were days that have since passed. I regret that. 96-3. Now, this was a person who worked for the ACLU, someone who was known in progressive circles as an icon. Apparently, just about every Republican voted for her. Her good friend on the court, Justice Scalia, I think got 97 votes. I don't know what happened between then and now. I guess we can all take some blame. But I just want to remind everybody, there was a time in this country where someone like Ruth Bader Ginsburg was seen by almost everybody as qualified for the position of being on the Supreme Court, understanding that she would have a different philosophy than many of the Republicans who voted for her. 27 years on the court, before becoming a member of the court, she was an active litigator, pushing for more equal justice and better rights for women throughout the country. Her close friend, until his death, Justice Scalia called her the leading and very successful litigator on behalf of women's rights, the Thurgood Marshall of that cause. What high praise. I can't say any more than that statement says. In my view, the person appearing before this committee is in a category of excellence, something the country should be proud of, and she will have a chance to make her case to be a worthy successor and to become the 9th member of the Supreme Court of the United States. On September the 26th, Judge Amy Barrett was nominated by President Trump to the Supreme Court. Who is she? She is a judge sitting on the 7th Judicial Circuit. She's highly respected. She was a professor at Notre Dame. 3 years during that tenure, she was chosen by the students to be the best professor, which I'm sure is no easy task at any college. She's widely admired for her integrity. She grew up in New Orleans, graduated from Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee in 1994, graduated summa cum laude and first in her class from Notre Dame Law School in 1997. So academically, she's very gifted. She clerked for Judge Lawrence Silberman on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and then for Justice Scalia on the Supreme Court. She practiced law in Washington, D.C. She joined the faculty at Notre Dame in 2002. She's published numerous articles in prestigious journals, including the Columbia University of Virginia and Cornell Law Review. She's been a circuit court judge at the 7th Circuit since 2017. She was confirmed to that position with a bipartisan vote. She has heard hundreds of cases in that capacity. She said, "I clerked for Justice Scalia more than 20 years ago, but the lessons I learned still resonate. His judicial philosophy is mine. A judge must apply the law as written. Judges are not policymakers, and they must be resolute in setting aside any policy views they might hold." She will give her statement, but I think that is a good summary of who she is. That's who Amy Barrett is in terms of the law. In terms of Amy Barrett, the individual, she and her husband have 7 children, 2 adopted. So 9 seems to be a good number. The process. This is an election year. We're confirming the judge in an election year after the voting has occurred. What will happen is that my Democratic colleagues will say, "This has never been done," and they're right in this regard. Nobody's, I think, has ever been confirmed in an election year past July. The bottom line is Justice Ginsburg, when asked about this several years ago, said that a president serves for 4 years, not 3. There's nothing unconstitutional about this process. This is a vacancy that's occurred through a tragic loss of a great woman, and we're going to fill that vacancy with another great woman. The bottom line here is that the Senate is doing its duty constitutionally.
Senator Lindsey Graham, earlier today, Democrats had argued that lawmakers should have been tested for coronavirus before the hearing as a precaution, but Senator Graham said that was not necessary. Senator Dianne Feinstein, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, wasted no time painting the GOP's move to quickly confirm Judge Barrett as an attempt to upend the Affordable Care Act and its protections for people with pre-existing medical conditions. Democrats over the past several days have agreed to hammer the health care issue over and over during the Barrett hearings, convinced they could turn voters away from the GOP and President Trump simultaneously. Here's Senator Feinstein of California.
Justice Ginsburg's nomination was the first one that I participated in when I came to the Senate. And it was a real thrill to be part of that crowded and celebratory hearing for someone who had broken down barriers and reopened doors and staunchly believed in a woman's right to full equality and autonomy. In filling Judge Ginsburg's seat, the stakes are extraordinarily high for the American people, both in the short term and for decades to come. Most importantly, health care coverage for millions of Americans is at stake with this nomination. So over the course of these hearings, my colleagues and I will focus on that subject. We will examine the consequences if, and that's a big if, Republicans succeed in rushing this nomination through the Senate before the next president takes office. But most importantly, in just a few weeks, on November 10th, the Supreme Court will hear hearings in Texas v. California, a case brought to strike down the ACA. The president has promised to appoint justices who will vote to dismantle that law. As a candidate, he criticized the Supreme Court for upholding the law and said, and I quote, "If I win the presidency, my judicial appointments will do the right thing, unlike Bush's appointee, John Roberts, on Obamacare," end quote. And when he appointed Judge Barrett to fill Justice Ginsburg's seat, the president said that eliminating the Affordable Care Act would be, quote, "a big win for the USA." Judge Barrett, you've been critical of Chief Justice Roberts for his 5-4 opinion upholding the law, stating that Roberts, quote, "pushed the Affordable Care Act beyond its plausible meaning to save the statute," end quote. This well could mean that if Judge Barrett is confirmed, Americans stand to lose the benefits that the ACA provides. So I hope you will clarify that in this hearing. First, more than 130 million Americans with pre-existing conditions like cancer, asthma, or even COVID-19 could be denied coverage or charged more to obtain health insurance. This includes more than 16.8 million Californians with pre-existing conditions. And we are just one state, but I think you should know how we feel. Secondly, some 12 million working Americans are covered through the ACA's Medicaid expansion. If the act is struck down, they lose their health care. Third, more than 2 million Americans under the age of 26 are covered by their parents' health insurance, and they could lose that coverage. Fourth, insurers could charge higher premiums for women simply because of their gender. And fifth, women could lose access to critical preventive services and maternity care, including cancer screenings and well woman visits. Now, the bottom line is this. There have been 70 attempts to repeal the ACA, but clearly the effort to dismantle the law continues, and they are asking the Supreme Court to strike down the Affordable Care Act. This, I believe, will cause tremendous harm. Consider people like Christina Munro Garcia of my home state. At age 60, Christina's eyesight started to fail because of cataracts. She had always struggled to obtain insurance because of pre-existing conditions, including C-sections and epilepsy. The cost of coverage, when it was even offered to her, averaged between $2,500 and $3,000 a month, far more than she and her husband could afford. In 2010, she was able to obtain coverage through the Affordable Care Act. Within weeks, she was able to have cataract surgery. This saved her life. Christina described her reaction when she was able to get coverage through the California Health Exchange following passage of the ACA. And let me quote, "It was like manna from heaven. I cried. After all these years of struggling to obtain coverage, I was able to get insurance through the California Exchange, no questions asked about my pre-existing conditions. The premium was worth $200 a month as compared to the $2,500 to $3,000 monthly payments I would have to pay before the ACA, if I could even get an insurer to offer me coverage." As Christina further explained, and I quote, "People just don't understand what it was like, the incredible fear before the Affordable Care Act, having to worry about being able to cover medical expenses and not being able to find affordable insurance," end quote. We can't afford to go back to those days when Americans could be denied coverage or charged exorbitant amounts.
Senator Dianne Feinstein earlier today. You're listening to Washington Today.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
No Democrats mentioned Judge Barrett's Catholic faith on Monday, but several Republican senators referenced remarks made by Senator Feinstein during Judge Barrett's Seventh Circuit Court nomination hearing from a few years ago. Here's more reaction to that from Republican Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri.
I've gotten to read a lot about you in the press, and in particular about your religious beliefs. One attack after another in the liberal media, one hit piece after another, many of them echoed by members of this committee, like this one, for instance, Barrett, long active with Insular Christian Group. We've read stories about your Catholic lifestyle, stories about how you raise your children, stories about how you adopted your children, stories about your Catholic doctrinal beliefs, over and over and over questioning whether you have, I guess, the independence to be a judge, a justice on the United States Supreme Court. And it's not just in the newspapers, it's members of this committee, including the Democratic nominee for Vice President of the United States, who has questioned past nominees who have come before this committee about their membership in Catholic fraternal organizations like the Knights of Columbus. And for those watching at home, that's right, you heard me correctly. Senator Harris and others on this committee have repeatedly questioned judicial nominees' fitness for office because of their membership in the Knights of Columbus. The ranking member, when you were last before this committee, Judge, for your initial confirmation hearings, the ranking member referred to your Catholic convictions as dogma, that's a quote, that lives loudly within you, picking up the very terminology of anti-Catholic bigotry current in this country a century ago. She wasn't alone. Other senators on this committee last time asked you if you were an Orthodox Catholic. One senator said she worried that you would be a Catholic judge if you were confirmed because of your religious beliefs. I guess as opposed to an American judge, as if you can't be both a devout Catholic and a loyal American citizen. And it's not just you, Judge. Other nominees who have come before this committee for years now have been asked by my Democrat colleagues over and over their views on sin, their views on the afterlife, their views and about their membership statements of Catholic organizations, about their membership in other Christian organizations, and on and on and on. And let's be clear about what this is. This is an attempt to broach a new frontier, to set up a new standard. Actually, it's an attempt to bring back an old standard that the Constitution of the United States explicitly forbids. I'm talking about a religious test for office. Article 6 of the Constitution of the United States, before we even get to the Bill of Rights, Article 6 of the Constitution of the United States says clearly, and I quote, "No religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States." Now, that was big news in 1787 when it was written, and it's worth remembering why. It's because no country, no republic in the history of the world had ever guaranteed to its citizens the right to freedom of conscience and religious liberty. Every other country that had ever existed tied together the religious beliefs that would be approved by the powerful and the right to serve in office or to vote or just to be a citizen. In every other country across history, you had to agree with what those in power agreed with in order to hold office or be a citizen in good standing. You had to sign a particular religious confession, or you had to disavow a particular religious group, swear not to follow the Pope, for instance. You had to pledge allegiance to the god of the city or the god of the empire. This was true from 18th century Britain all the way back to ancient Rome. And so when our founders put Article 6 into the Constitution of the United States, they were making a very deliberate choice. They were breaking with all of that past history, and they were saying in America, it would be different. In the United States of America, we would not allow the ruling class to have veto power over your faith, over what Americans believed, over who we gathered with to worship, and why, and where, and how. No, in this country, the people of the United States would be free to follow their own religious convictions, free to worship, free to exercise their religion, and people of faith would be welcome in the public sphere. They'd be welcome there. They'd be welcome without having to get the approval of those in power, like those on this committee. They would be welcome to come and to bring their religious beliefs to bear on their lives, on their office, and all that they do, so long, of course, as they were peaceful citizens who followed the law. Religious people of all backgrounds would be welcome in public life.
Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri earlier today. In a brief exchange with reporters Monday, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden said Judge Barrett's Catholic faith should not be an issue at her confirmation hearing and that senators should focus on the potential that she would derail the Affordable Care Act. This echoing arguments of Democratic senators on the Judiciary Committee, quote, "No faith should not be considered," Biden told reporters before boarding his plane in Delaware en route to Florida, quote, "No one's faith should be questioned," end quote. Joe Biden's running mate, Senator Kamala Harris, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, echoed the health care message of other Senate Democrats and warned that confirming Judge Barrett to the Supreme Court would precipitate the demise of the Affordable Care Act. Like the other Democrats who spoke before her, Senator Harris, in her opening remarks, told the story of a constituent who has benefited from the protections of the 2010 health care law, an 11-year-old girl named Micah from Southern California, who has a congenital heart defect and has to see multiple specialists during the year. Here's a portion of Senator Harris's remarks.
This hearing has brought together more than 50 people to sit inside of a closed-door room for hours while our nation is facing a deadly airborne virus. This committee has ignored common sense requests to keep people safe, including not requiring testing for all members, despite a coronavirus outbreak among senators of this very committee. By contrast, in response to this recent Senate outbreak, the leaders of Senate Republicans rightly postponed business on the Senate floor this week to protect the health and safety of senators and staff. Mr. Chairman, for the same reasons, this hearing should have been postponed. The decision to hold this hearing now is reckless and places facilities workers, janitorial staff, and congressional aides and Capitol Police at risk. Not to mention that while tens of millions of Americans are struggling to pay their bills, the Senate should be prioritizing coronavirus relief and providing financial support to those families. The American people need to have help to make rent or their mortgage payment. We should provide financial assistance to those who have lost their job and help parents put food on the table. Small businesses need help, as do the cities, towns, and hospitals that this crisis has pushed to the brink. The House bill would help families and small businesses get through this crisis. But Senate Republicans have not lifted a finger for 150 days, which is how long that bill has been here in the Senate, to move the bill. Yet, this committee is determined to rush a Supreme Court confirmation hearing through in just 16 days. Senate Republicans have made it crystal clear that rushing a Supreme Court nomination is more important than helping and supporting the American people who are suffering from a deadly pandemic and a devastating economic crisis. Their priorities are not the American people's priorities. But for the moment, Senate Republicans hold a majority in the Senate and determine the schedule. So here we are. The Constitution of the United States entrusts the Senate with the solemn duty to carefully consider nominations for lifetime appointments to the United States Supreme Court. Yet the Senate majority is rushing this process and jamming President Trump's nominee through the Senate while people are actually voting just 22 days before the end of the election. More than 9 million Americans have already voted, and millions more will vote while this illegitimate committee process is underway. A clear majority of Americans want whomever wins this election to fill this seat. And my Republican colleagues know that. Yet, they are deliberately defying the will of the people in their attempt to roll back the rights and protections provided under the Affordable Care Act. And let's remember, in 2017, President Trump and congressional Republicans repeatedly tried to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. But remember, people from all walks of life spoke out and demanded Republicans stop trying to take away the American people's health care. Republicans finally realized that the Affordable Care Act is too popular to repeal in Congress. So now they are trying to bypass the will of the voters and have the Supreme Court do their dirty work. That's why President Trump promised to only nominate judges who will get rid of the Affordable Care Act. This administration, with the support of Senate Republicans, will be in front of the Supreme Court on November 10th to argue that the entire Affordable Care Act should be struck down. That's in 29 days that that'll happen. And that's a big reason why Senate Republicans are rushing this process. They are trying to get a justice onto the court in time to ensure they can strip away the protections of the Affordable Care Act. And if they succeed, it will result in millions of people losing access to health care at the worst possible time, in the middle of a pandemic.
That was Senator Kamala Harris, Democrat of California, and the vice presidential nominee earlier today. Under the GOP timeline, the Senate Judiciary Committee will hold a vote on Judge Barrett's nomination on October 22nd. Now, that would set up the full Senate to confirm her during the final week of October, where she will need at least 50 yes votes and Vice President Pence to break a potential tie. You can find this entire hearing on our website at cspan.org and follow along each day as we air the hearings live on C-SPAN, online at cspan.org, and right here on C-SPAN Radio. Before we leave you today, the mother of the late Arizona Republican Senator John McCain passed away today at her home in Washington. She was 108. Roberta Wright McCain was an independent-minded oil heiress who was married to one of the Navy's highest-ranking officers. In 2008, at age 96, she hit the campaign trail on behalf of her son, Senator John McCain. Her husband, John S. McCain Jr., a four-star Navy admiral, led the U.S. invasion of the Dominican Republic in 1965 and commanded U.S. forces in the Pacific during the Vietnam War. John S. McCain Jr. had a heart attack on a transatlantic flight home to Washington and died in 1981. Roberta McCain's daughter, Jean Alexandra, or Sandy as she's known as, Morgan, died in 2009. Survivors include a son, Joseph P. McCain of Washington, 10 grandchildren, and 11 great-grandchildren. C-SPAN interviewed Mrs. McCain at her home in Washington back in 2008. She spoke about her views on her long life.
Listen, be grateful for what you got and forget what you don't have. And I am so grateful for the life that we had. I can't have a regret. I have nothing but gratitude for what God's given me.
And as you look at this year ahead, what's it like for you to see your son go through the process of running for president? Does it
bother
you?
If everybody goes well, I thank God for that. And if everything doesn't go well, I understand.
But do you ever call him up and say, you should have done this?
No.
Or good job on that?
No. First place, I'm not competent. But the next place, there are people a lot smarter than I am that would tell him. Honey, sons don't want to hear too much advice from their mother.
Roberta Wright McCain was 108 years old. You can find this entire interview on our website at cspan.org. If you've missed any part of this episode, you can find it on the free C-SPAN radio app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for joining us today on Washington Today. Have a great evening.